Well, I want to say good morning to everyone. It's great to be here in Boone at the Farm Progress Show. It is particularly a good opportunity for me when I was governor of the state, for those who are visitors to Iowa. One of the programs we had was Vision Iowa, which provided resources to help build capital projects. And one of the great applications for Vision Iowa was the Farm Progress Show here in Boone, being able to use resources to upgrade the facility so that Iowa could make the case along with Illinois that we were the best location to have this particular opportunity. So it's great to see what the folks with the Farm Progress Show have done. They continue to expand in both locations. It continues to be a very popular place for farmers and ranchers to find out what's next. And it's also an opportunity for our foreign friends, our foreign visitors, to come and see the extraordinary progress of American agriculture. I said earlier today on a interview that American agriculture is always, always about tomorrow. It's never really about yesterday. It's always about what's new, what can we do to be more productive, what can we do to expand opportunity in rural parts of our country, what can we do to make agriculture of interest to every generation. And we at USDA have been working hard the last 6 or 7 months to make sure that we encourage that next generation of farmers and ranchers across all aspects of agriculture. We've got, despite the challenges of this year's weather and the drought, the future of agriculture is bright. We've had some extraordinary successful years recently, and we want to build on that. And we want to encourage the next generation to become interested and involved in agriculture. So we started earlier this year by looking at ways in which we might make it a bit easier for some of our farm families to expand and to encourage young people. One of the first things we did was to take a look at our own loan programs through the Farm Service Agency, and John Whitaker is here from Iowa's Farm Service Agency, and he can tell you that we have expanded significantly our efforts to reach out to beginning farmers, socially disadvantaged farmers, to make sure that the credit for operating and ownership is available, and we've seen record amounts of credit in the last 3.5 years, about $18 billion of credit to farm families. 131,000 farm families across the United States getting the opportunity to get into this business. We also took a look at ways in which we could expand our guaranteed program. And one of the things we recognized was that our loan programs were great. They worked with our commercial banking friends to provide guarantees. But many times, individual landowners were interested in selling their land on contract, long-term contracts. And one of the ways in which we could encourage that opportunity, which might make it a bit easier for our farm, for beginning farmers, was to take a look at ways in which we might be able to extend our guarantee program to farm contracts, long-term contracts. So we started in 6 states, and in January we announced that our efforts will now be expanded to all 50 states where land contracts can receive guarantees. We took a look at risk management. And we recognized that there needed to be better opportunities for young farmers to understand crop insurance, to understand the risk management tools. And so we began an aggressive effort through RMA to provide training and information to beginning farmers so that they understood how to utilize this important tool. And we began to adjust a bit the qualifications for insurance in terms of prior experience. Our experience levels were basically discouraging some of the beginning farmers from getting into this business, and so we created greater flexibility this year in that effort. We also teamed up with the Farm Bureau to provide more online information for beginning farmers. It's a lot of information you've got to consider and think about when you take the plunge to get into this business. And so with the Farm Bureau's help, we established a website, www.start2farm.gov, which provides information about programs and also the kinds of things that you need to be thinking about if you're going to get into this business. So today we want to expand on that, and we make announcements today of $18 million of grant money available to the USDA in the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program. This is a program that's been operating for some time, but we're seeing expanded utilization of it. When it started several years ago, it helped about 5,000 producers. With today's announcements, we expect and anticipate to provide assistance and help to about 38,000 producers across the country. These $18 million in grants will be distributed to universities, to nonprofit organizations that will be providing help and assistance and training, specific information ranging from estate planning to putting together a business plan, to risk management understandings, to all of the information that's necessary to encourage people to get into this business. 24 states, $18 million, and we think 38,000 producers. Let me give you a couple of examples of ways in which these resources will be used. In North Carolina, there's the Appalachian Sustainable Ag Project, which is going to reach out to nearly 1,000 producers and give them information and techniques on how they might be able to expand their sustainability efforts. Just visiting before we started with folks about the importance of cover crops and the expanded use of cover crops, I think we're going to continue to see a lot more of that. And so if we can get our beginning farmers to understand that more effectively, I think that we'll see obviously more of that activity. In Arkansas and Oklahoma, we're working with returning veterans. You know, we've seen a real interest in providing grant money to organizations in Arkansas and Oklahoma that will reach out to veterans who are interested in potentially starting a new career when they leave the military. We're going to have over 1 million young people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan looking for work, and we've provided tax credits for small businesses to hire these folks, but a lot of them are interested in farming and living in a rural area. Some of them may have actually worked in Afghanistan helping to establish the Afghan farm economy. So we're providing assistance and help through this program for those military veterans. In Nebraska and South Dakota, we're working with legal aid. And we've got Michelle Soule from the Nebraska Legal Aid here today. Michelle, just wave your hand there. Michelle is here representing Legal Aid, who is a recipient of resources. And what they're going to do is provide legal counsel the opportunity to sit down with farmers and explain to them the issues of risk management and crop insurance. Aflatoxin right now is an issue, and obviously people need to understand and appreciate what their responsibilities are in terms of advising and educating their agents about potential loss. This is the kind of help and assistance that a beginning farmer, if you didn't have, it could make the difference between you staying in business or not. There's also transition planning. How can individuals work with others in estate planning to potentially get new opportunities? In the state of Iowa, we're working with the Women Food and Ag Network, and Lee Adcock is here. Lee is right here, over here. And they are working with an expanded group of individuals that we're seeing in the new census information, a great interest on the part of women in America to get back into the business of farming and producing. And so they'll be working with women farmers in Iowa and in Nebraska as well, giving them information and perhaps most importantly, linking them up with folks who are already in the business, women who are already in the farming business, to provide mentoring opportunities. Nothing better than when you start a new enterprise to have somebody who's been there, done that, assist and help you in providing information and advice. We've got a number of other folks here from past winners. Raymond Hansen and Madeline Schultz are from Iowa State. They're here. Last year, Iowa State was an awardee under this program, and we're certainly proud of Iowa State's role as a land-grant university as we celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Morrell Act and Iowa State's role in becoming one of the premier land-grant universities. Also with us in 2010, the Practical Farmers of Iowa were a recipient. Luke Grant is with us as well. Luke is right here. It's good to see Luke. He used to work in my office when I was governor as an intern. He's gotten a lot taller. I'm shrinking. I'm not sure which, or maybe it's a combination of both. But it's good to see him. You know, this is one of those important programs, the future of which is somewhat dependent on Congress being able to do its work and continue and finish its work A number of us are sporting these Farm Bill Now buttons. And I think, Secretary Northey, you'd agree with me that we're all it would be in better shape if we had the work done in Congress, encouraging the House to finish its work on the bill so whatever differences can be worked out between the Senate and the House before the expiration on September 30th. It's important for not just this program, but it's important for the dairy operators whose programs are somewhat dependent upon a continuation of these programs. It obviously would contain potentially some disaster assistance for livestock producers and dairy producers and specialty crop producers who've been hit hard by the drought. It would allow us to continue trade promotion. Later today, we'll have our updated forecast on trade and exports. We know we've had a number of good, positive years in trade export. We want to obviously send the message to the rest of the world that we're in the business of trade. We're going to continue to export agricultural products. We just had our farm income report suggesting we're going to have another strong farm income year, in part because of the safety net that's incorporated in any farm bill provision. CRP, the energy title, the ability to provide assistance and to avoid the uncertainty of what policies might likely be next year for commodities, all of which I think play to the importance of getting this done and getting it done in September, providing that certainty and providing a continuation of the momentum that we've seen in rural areas, notwithstanding the very difficult year we've had with drought and now with additional storms in the south. So with that, I'd be glad to answer questions if there are any. Yes, Jeff. Well, Jeff, let me point out that what this president has done, I think, in my view, is put together a framework that did not exist in rural America in terms of a strategy for rural development and rural opportunity in agriculture and in rural communities. Four parts to it: production, agriculture, and exports. I think you would continue to see an aggressive effort, as you've seen in this administration, with free trade agreements, with knocking down sanitary and phytosanitary barriers, roughly 1,500 a year. Continued promotion of trade on a bilateral basis with our beef trade in particular, trying to knock down these barriers that have existed for far too long. So production, agriculture, and exports, I don't think anybody can question the last 4 years have been the strongest export years we've had. That would continue with the Trans-Pacific Partnership discussions and hopefully leading to an extraordinary agreement that would bring into play hundreds of millions of additional consumers. Second piece of this is the bio-based economy. The ability to produce from plant material, from crop material, livestock waste, virtually every aspect of an economy, from the fuel and energy that we know that we see today, that reduces our reliance on foreign oil, provides consumers choice and a little extra cash at the pump because pump prices would be much more expensive if it were not for biofuel. But extending that, when I came in here today, I saw all this extraordinary farm machinery. And it prompted me to think about my recent trip to the Innovation Center of Ford Motor Company in Michigan, where they are literally experimenting on making every part of an automobile from crops. So you don't often get Jeff Nally to raise his eyebrows about something, but I just did. They started with soybeans and tires. They're working on Virginia Tech. They're working on materials that would make the body of an automobile. The seats for every Ford Motor Company vehicle that's produced in North America today, soy-based. I actually, along with Chairwoman Stabenow, made some of this soy-based foam. It's amazing. So the bio-based opportunities, and the president has basically committed to this, by making sure that the federal government does its part in purchasing those bio-preferred and bio-based products, expanding that. So you'd see a continuation, aggressive continuation of that. You would continue to see a promotion of local and regional food systems. Now, I know there are some people who are skeptical about that, but it is a multi-billion dollar industry. A multi-billion dollar industry. Why wouldn't we want to promote that? Why wouldn't we want to give a woman farmer an opportunity to participate and provide local produce to a school? Why wouldn't we want to do that? So we would continue to promote that, as we have. We've seen an expansion of farmers markets that's historic, food hubs, and the supply chain. Also creates jobs in rural areas. You'd see a continuation of that. And then finally, the conservation and linkage to outdoor recreation. Record number of acres enrolled in conservation. We would continue to focus on large landscape-scale operations. Secretary Northey is well aware of our investment in Iowa and the Upper Mississippi River Basin, the water quality initiative, the collaborative landscape efforts in parts across the country. You'd see a continuation of that. You would want to build on the momentum that we've seen, and we want to continue that because these have been some of the best years we've seen in farm country in a long, long time. Now, as it relates to the regulatory, I think you'd continue to see what you've seen the last several years, which is an aggressive USDA helping its sister agencies understand the implications of proposals. You know, I've heard a lot about this recently, and frankly, you know, when things are, when you got record income and you got record exports, you got record acres enrolled in conservation, you got record expansion of bio-based products, you got record expansion of local and regional food systems, you can't really talk about the economy. So you got to talk about something, you got to frighten people. So we talk about regulations that either don't exist, aren't going to exist, or would never be considered. We're going to continue to knock that stuff down. Let me just give you an example. This issue of child labor. Fair enough. People were very concerned about that, and with good reason. We went to the department and said, hey, do you guys understand how this is being interpreted, how it's understood? We sat down with labor. We got them to basically pull off that law, that rule. And then we said, but, you know, everybody in the countryside is concerned about child safety. We're all concerned about that. So let's do this a different way. Let's do it in an informative, educational way. Let's provide incentives. So we've sat down with Farm Bureau and the National Farmers Union and other groups, farm groups and safety groups, and we're working on creating essentially the equivalent of a university, a safety university, where you'll be able to have information available on the web that could be used through 4-H, through FFA, through any other organization that will provide very basic understanding of safety issues for the farm, for farm kids. And then elevate, as you would in a university. You know, after the first year, you take your core courses, then you start taking more advanced courses. There would be individual units of advanced safety. You're going to use some of this equipment. You need to know how to use it. That's the way we're going to continue to do these things. So I'm excited about what's happening in rural America. You know, we've got this drought, and it just points out how resilient American agriculture is, how extraordinary these producers are. You talk to them. And unlike the national media that sort of gets all wound up about all this, these guys say, you know, yeah, it's part of it. I'll deal with it. I'm disappointed. Thought I was going to have a great crop. Had crop insurance. Livestock producers are saying, you know, with a farm bill, we'll be able to get some support and help. We'll get through this. It's not easy. It's tough, but we're tougher. So I'm optimistic about the future. Now you got me raise my eyebrows. Well, first of all, we're doing everything we can, Ken, within the powers that we have. And we've done, you know, we just announced an extension of our CRP, hay and grazing opportunities, for a couple of months. We provided greater flexibility in that program. We've not charged folks as much as normally we would for repaying on the rental rates. We've worked with our sister agencies to extend credit through the SBA, through credit unions, through USDA's emergency loan program. We've provided additional resources through our conservation programs for water issues. You know, we're working with crop insurance to encourage that double cropping opportunity and the cover crop opportunity that might make it a little bit easier for our livestock producers in terms of forage. We've streamlined the disaster program. We've worked with crop insurance companies so that we don't get charged interest until November on unpaid premiums. We're working with the DOT, and hopefully Secretary Northey will work with his colleagues in the State Department of Transportation to look at truck weights and truck lengths We're working on hours of service at the federal level to make sure that folks don't have to make as many trips as possible. So we're doing as much as we possibly can. But the reality is the most specific and most direct help for producers will come when we have a food, farm, and jobs bill, because that will contain the capacity to go back, resurrect, if you will, revive, retroactively put in force those disaster programs, may also include additional assistance and help for specialty crop producers, and it will put into place a much better system potentially for dairy producers. But there are other implications to this drought. There are implications that go beyond the farm, that extend into communities that are impacted by drought. So, for example, you may have a small community that basically is concerned about its water resources for its citizens and the businesses that happen to be located in that community. So we need to be thinking further down the road than just today. We need to be thinking about what does this do next year? How does it impact? What is the rippling effect? And so the president put together a rural council, Ken, which is the first time a president has ever done this, putting together all of the people in the cabinet that have any impact with rural America and putting them in a room and saying, work together, integrate, and coordinate programs. He charged the rural council with basically overseeing this drought impact. And to do that, we need to make sure that not just the cabinet secretaries are talking to each other, but that the folks on the ground floor, the grassroots of government, are communicating with each other. So we will likely be putting together some kind of mechanism for that to happen. Colleen will be part of that from the USDA perspective. And that will ensure that we're getting all the information from all the agencies about the rippling impact and effect of a drought. And that will, I think, help to inform us and inform Congress about steps that may be taken. We have limited resources, for example, in our rural utility service to provide emergency water assistance. Maybe that's a place where this group would come in and say, we can move money around or we can ask Congress for additional money, whatever, those kinds of things. Yes, sir.
Mark has USA has asked you to suspend all contracts between Cattlemen's Beef Board and MCBA until a lawsuit is resolved. What do you want to tell us about that, and what do you intend to do?
Well, let me just say that I've been pleased by the progress that has been made between the various entities that are involved with the beef checkoff. Obviously, there were deep concerns that were expressed over the course of the last several years, and those concerns led to a number of meetings that have taken place, and I think we're in a better place. We are in the process of fulfilling and completing an audit. That's also going to tell us some additional information, and I'm not going to take and make decisions until I have all the information I need to have. But I will say that I am pleased about the level of cooperation and communication that's now taking place between the various entities. Much improved, much better. We've also put in place a rule that I think will create greater flexibility in the utilization of those resources, so not just one entity qualifies, that we actually open it up for additional entities. I think that's about what we're going to do. And when we get the audit, there may be additional steps that we announce, but I want to know what the audit says before I make any additional announcements. Help me a little bit. I'm just not.
Well, just in the case of farm program payments, subsidy payments, and just that under all that, and who else do you partner with to make those investigations?
Well, we have several folks who provide oversight to USDA and appropriate oversight. And one of the first persons I met with when I became secretary was the Inspector General, USDA, Phyllis Fong, and I assured her that my view of inspector generals was a positive one, which is that they provide an important service. They provide an opportunity for us to learn how to do our job better. Obviously, the General Accounting Office of Congress also provides oversight. Of course, the congressional committees provide oversight. So there are a lot of people basically telling us how we could improve on things. I will tell you that we have worked within risk management to reduce error rates. We have worked within the Farm Service Agency to make sure that that people who are qualified get a fair shake. That's been the primary focus here. The fact that I think we're doing a little bit more with beginning farmers and socially disadvantaged farmers has probably reduced a bit the criticism of USDA in terms of its credit programs. So we'll continue to work with the Inspector General. We'll continue to work with the General Accounting Office if they come up with suggestions or conclusions. We're obviously looking for ways in which we can reduce error rate. Our significant focus in this area is not necessarily in the programs that you mentioned, but in the nutrition assistance programs, where we now have an historic low fraud rate and historic low error rate in those programs, but we're not satisfied with that. We need to do more, we want to do more, and we will do more. You know, it's a complex agency, does a lot of different things, and we're obviously looking at ways in which we can improve service. We are also engaged and involved in what is referred to as the Administrative Services Project, or part of our Blueprint for Strengthening Service. And that is really designed to deal with the fact that we're facing reduced budgets. And when you have reduced budgets, but yet you have continued demand for additional programs and additional help and assistance, it creates conflict. It creates a tension between the necessary staff to do all of the work that people need and want. So one way you deal with reduced budgets is to figure out ways in which you might be able to improve process, ways in which you are asking more questions than you need to ask, ways in which you are providing applications that are longer than they need to be, things of that nature. And the Administrative Services Project has gone through and extensively looked at ways in which we can be more efficient and more effective. We've already identified millions of dollars of savings and hundreds of thousands of hours of savings of time. But we're not done yet. We won't be done in terms of the recommendations that we've come up with probably for another year or so. Yes?
I wanted to ask you about the school lunch program. We've got new guidelines in, and I know the idea is to address the obesity issue, but I've heard complaints from mothers specifically about two issues in particular. One is that it seems like they're getting about the same amount of calories for a 5-year-old 11-year-old, they've got, you know, that there's no adjustment there. The other is a decreasing amount of protein, about 10 to 12 ounces a week for kids, and you got kids coming home hungry. So I wanted you to comment on, I understand the idea of making them healthier and more fruits and vegetables, but it seems like that there's some others out there that are concerned.
Well, first of all, moms need to know that school districts have a lot of flexibility, that your question didn't address, and I think it's important for me to point that out. There are a number of menus that are available to schools, and they get to choose from those menus, and some menus have varying degrees of protein levels, so that you need to make sure that your school district understands that they got options, and they need to think about those options. Secondly, oftentimes those options at the school level, because they're faced with reduced budgets and difficult budgets, they oftentimes are making decisions based on what they can actually fit within a budget. It's one of the reasons why we promoted and provided the first increase, non-inflationary increase in school lunch reimbursement to schools in 30 years as part of this effort, because we realized, hey, this may be a bit more expensive. Let's provide some help and assistance. The third thing is there's a changing focus of this school lunch program. When it started in 1946, it started because policymakers were concerned our kids weren't getting enough calories. They were concerned that there wouldn't be enough people to defend the country if we were attacked. And understanding the sensitivity of Pearl Harbor and so forth, you can understand that thought process. So we basically created, minimum levels of calories, and it was about consumption. And we did a pretty good job of that, frankly, over the last 60 years. Maybe too good a job. So now we're faced with admirals and generals coming up to us and saying, hey, we got a shrinking pool of kids qualified physically and otherwise to be in the military. Can you do something about that? So we went to the Institute of Medicine. They came back with a set of recommendations. And one recommendation was instead of minimum calories, maybe we should be focused on a maximum calorie kind of concept. And that's incorporated in that rule. So greater flexibility, understanding that the school programs are not designed to be all that youngsters have access to. We recognize what kids are eating at home. We know that moms and dads are making good decisions at home. We want to supplement and complement those. And I think at the end of the day, this combined with moms and dads doing what they do best will provide our youngsters with a balanced set of meals with adequate amount of protein for their brain development and for their physical strength, but at the same time dealing with the fact we got a third of our kids at risk of being obese or in fact obese. And as the First Lady says, it's not just calories in, it's also calories out. Maybe school districts ought to be also looking at restoring recess and, you know, some way of getting physical education back in the curriculum and all of those things. We all have work to do. But I think what's happening in the country is there's a slow transition, as there was in the 1940s. And I think we're getting to understand the balance. And you know, we're seeing that also throughout the world. As rising middle classes expand in places like China, you know, China last year was our number one trading partner, in large part because of what they were purchasing on the protein side. So I would expect that to continue. One more. Yes, sir.
I don't know. Maybe I have to step away. You may have to ask, but because you want to get the Farm Bill passed, you know what the House Ag Committee version is, you know what the Senate bill is. Once it goes to Congress, is there anything in either one of the two bills that would be palatable to the administration?
Well, I want to give the process a chance to work. One of the concerns, obviously, is why isn't the House taking the bill up? And this, it's suggested that there are folks in the House who disagree with the House Ag Committee version, and we may end up with reductions far more serious than those that we see today. For example, a budget has passed the House in which commodity price support, crop insurance support would be almost twice what the House Ag Committee proposed. Conservation cuts as well, deeper than what House Ag proposed, and substantially greater cuts to the nutrition program than what the House Ag Committee proposed and what the Senate passed. So right now we've got competing visions. Let me say this. Rather than answering your questions about what we don't like, let me say what we do like. We do like the fact that there's a commitment from both the House Ag Committee and the Senate on a strong safety net, and the fact that it's responding to concerns about systems that basically pay folks during good times but don't provide enough help during tough times. We think that both the House Ag and the Senate bill begin to address that issue. We think that there is significant agreement between the two bodies on the need for flexibility in the conservation programs. We won't need 20 programs if we have enough flexibility in a handful of programs to work with landowners on a more individualized basis. Our goal at NRCS, and I tell you, NRCS does fabulous work, our goal is to try to get more folks in the field, less people in the backroom offices, more people in the field doing more creative work with landowners. But we need flexibility in the programs to do that. We like a continuation of the trade promotion programs, which we believe are now investing historic levels of trade promotion that are leading to more trade shows, more reverse trade shows, more exchanges, and the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. We've seen record ag exports, and we continue to see, I think, strong ag exports. We like the idea that there's a continued commitment in the Senate version to an energy title that expands to this bio-based economy. That is not in the House version, and that needs to be addressed, and that's a concern that I have. We like the idea that the rural development programs that are so vital to job creation and to improving and strengthening communities are in the Senate version, not necessarily in the House Ag version, but at the end of the day, when they get into a conference, my sense is that those things can be worked out. Really like the opportunity to put more focus on ag research. We got folks from Iowa State. You know, there's some phenomenal research being done at our land-grant universities, but we flatlined ag investments in ag research until the last couple of years, where we've seen a slight increase. We need to see much more dramatic increase. We need the flexibility of drawing in private sector resources that other parts of government have, like in the healthcare area. That's addressed in the Senate version, and I also believe in the House version as well. So there are a lot of good things, but at the end of the day, we need it. We need it now. And we need it now. Yeah. Thank you. We need it now, and we need it now for three basic reasons. One, because it includes the disaster programs that are vital to livestock producers not having to liquidate their entire herd. You're a cattle operator and you liquidate your entire herd. It's not like a pork producer where you can get back in business in a relatively short period of time. That's it. Dairy producers under a lot of stress. And we said this in 2009 when we helped them out. Hey, guys, our tools are limited here. We got to have a food, farm, and jobs bill to help out these dairy producers. That's addressed. So disaster assistance. Second reason is certainty. I mean, you're a producer and you're trying to figure out what you're going to do next year. How would you possibly figure it out? What is the crop insurance program? Is there going to be assistance for double cropping? What is the commodity program? Is it going to be what we have? Is it going to be something different? I would imagine that that will have an impact on the decisions that you'll make. You need to know what the rules are. And the third reason is we've got momentum in rural America. We've got record farm income, record in exports, record enrollment in conservation practices, record activities in the bio-based area and in the local and regional food systems. We're tying this all together, and we're beginning to see unemployment come down in rural areas. Why would we want to stop that momentum by creating all of this uncertainty about what the programs are going to be? Or, golly, are we going to get back to 1940 ag policy? Really? I mean, people are asking me that question now. They're seriously asking me that question. I mean, can you imagine the uncertainty that creates? And then all of our trading partners out there wondering, well, are we going to continue to have trade promotion? We need it now. And there's no reason you can't get it done. Everybody in this tent knows. Everybody in this tent knows if it's a priority, Congress can move very quickly.